As Mayor Lenny Curry looks to demolish Jacksonville Landing, other communities' similar marketplaces are thriving, thanks to renovation projects. The race to be Florida's next governor is getting more visits to Jacksonville by candidates. Duval School Superintendent Dr. Diana Green officially takes over her job, and more intrigue at the Jacksonville City Council in the wake of the suspensions of Katrina and Reggie Brown, two indicted council people. Also, Mayor Curry's net worth is down, and transparency concerns at City Hall rebuffed by the council president and mayor's chief of staff. These are some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning, and thanks for listening. I'm A.G. Gankarski, and from Melissa Ross, and we are live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect this Friday. Just ahead, we'll hear about a busy week in the news with our media roundtable. We welcome your calls. 549-2937 is the number, also Facebook and Twitter. Then later, it's International Kissing Day. What's that? We'll tell you all about it. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and time for our weekly media roundtable. We welcome Dan Scanlon from the Florida Times-Union.
Good morning.
Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth.
Good morning.
And Jacksonville Business Journal editor Timothy Gibbons.
It is great to be here.
All right. Lots to talk about this week, but first this morning, a big crowd at Jacksonville Landing on Wednesday to watch the annual Independence Day fireworks display. But landing ownership in the city had been at odds for years, with the Curry administration now moving to evict Tony Slayman's company with plans to tear down the landing and create an urban riverfront park. But a recent Florida Times-Union report shows other cities with shopping centers like the Landing are doing the opposite, investing in those centers and making improvement to great success. So what's the solution for the Landing space? Demolition, infrastructure improvements, or what? Tim, let's start with you. You've been here for a long time. What do you think the Landing needs?
What does the Landing mean? The Landing needs people, everybody to, you know, basically chill out a little bit. It's interesting where there are some who basically would praise the Curry administration for finally bringing this to a head. The Landing issue has been one that's been just going on forever. The problem is the way that they're bringing it to a head has basically turned into a pissing match between the owners of the Landing and the administration in a way that is generating far more heat than light and isn't actually leading to anything. I mean, if you go back, 4 or 5 years, the DIA was having charrettes. They were trying to figure out what to do with it. I don't get the sense that the city is trying to figure out what to do with it right now so much as just be punitive towards Slayman.
So you think it's political power play?
Well, at least a little bit, yeah.
I mean, that's a Slayman claim. Dan, you've been reporting this market since the Landing opened. What changes have you noticed at the Landing over the years?
Well, you know, I'm one of the really old guys here, and I can remember when there was a warehouse at that site. That's back in the Godbold era. Frankly, while it's a nice idea to bulldoze it and make it a park, the best thing if you did that was to make that marina an active place so that at least you have a reason to be there. People have a reason to park there. Slayman's old idea to open it up to the street and put in some retail and maybe a hotel is a lovely idea. But the other thing is you have so much empty space down the river between the Berkman II shell, between the old city hall, the old shipyards, and the old courthouse, and nothing is happening per se there. So why add anything to the Landing if it's Deadsville all the way down to Metro Park, which in itself needs an redo.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to close existing businesses so that you can tear down a property and create more empty space along the riverfront. I think a lot of us have been watching this for many years, and the Brown administration wanted to do something with the Landing, including a remodel, a renovation, or tear down. And Tony Slayman has told me and others that he is absolutely on board with doing something different with the Landing. He wants to be involved with it. What seems to be happening right now is the Curry administration is just committed to not having Slayman Enterprises be involved in any way with the Landing. And we keep asking ourselves, what is the motivation behind that? Is it legitimately because they don't feel that the Landing has been operated as a first-class marketplace? Or is it more a personal thing because Slayman supported Alvin Brown in the 2015 election, as many have suggested, and I'm sure the mayor would deny strongly?
I know, AJ, yeah. You reported on the Tea Party involvement in this fight, and the idea that you now have Slayman supporters basically coming out really attacking the Curry administration. And it's an interesting kind of change of tune where you would have thought a few years ago that Slayman and a Republican mayor would be much more simpatico than, as it was, Alvin Brown and Tony Slayman.
Right. Those are all great points. I want to take a call. We want to get your calls at 549-2937. We've got Eric in Arlington. Eric, go ahead. Eric? Eric. Okay.
Eric has been torn down and turned into a park.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's one of the proposals that we have going there, basically, is, you know, the tear down to build into the park. And that was something that's floated last week. Tell us a little bit about that, Tim.
See, it's an interesting plan to basically turn it back to parkland and add some green space to downtown. The interesting bit in that goes back to that question of trying to figure out what the heck do we actually want to do with downtown. We're going to tear down the old courthouse. Okay, what do we want to put there? Maybe a convention center, maybe something else. Nobody really exactly knows. We want to tear down the landing. We want to put parks there. Well, do we need parks? Is that actually something that the city has determined is the highest and best use of that property? In some ways, it's almost putting the cart before the horse to say this is the plan that we're going with. And you will note that the administration has not actually officially said that is what they want to do with it. It's just kind of been floated out there as a potential, we're looking at it.
Right. Okay, we're going to try Eric again. Eric, you on the air?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead. Gary? Yes, sir, go ahead.
Okay. You just hit on, whoever it was, one of y'all just hit on the main point, the main problem, and that is, what is the big picture idea for downtown? Recently, there was a University of Florida study that showed that that sea level rise was happening four times as fast along the eastern seaboard as it is in other places in the world. There are climate change models. There's lots of different ones. But there's one that came out recently that showed Florida completely underwater in 70 years. The idea of throwing money at a low-lying area, billions of dollars possibly, right along the river that has been dredged to the point that it's very susceptible to these incremental rises in sea level is absurd. And somebody downtown, I don't know if it's the city council, the media, the mayor, somebody needs to get a hold of the situation and really start making plans to mitigate the problems that we're going to have with sea level rise and stop worrying about building new restaurants and shops along the river. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Claire, what do you think about that, the environmental issues? Obviously, we've got the dredging coming. We've seen historic floods with Irma. That could be the shape of things to come. Do we need to look at downtown development a different way?
Perhaps we do. I mean, if we're really going to look at the long game in terms of development, we need to talk about not 5 years from now, but 50 years from now, even maybe 100 years from now, when we're thinking strategically about what it's going to look like in downtown Jacksonville. As this dredging has progressed, the volume of water that is in the river has increased, so much over the past 100 years. As the recent Times Union report pointed out, it's become ever saltier and more like the ocean. And when we have these great flood events, as we have had twice in recent years, then we see more and more damage. The landing itself took some damage in the past hurricane that did require some renovations. And even the Wells Fargo across the street, their basement flooded and that building was closed for months. If we see more and more of these, we're talking about a lot more cost to both private citizens and businesses and taxpayers. And this the infrastructural dangers that are, how long will the landing be able to stay where it is if in 20 years from now it's getting nuisance flooding on every high tide? Good question to ask.
Yeah, thank you. I got another call here, Jay from Orange Park. He wants to talk about the landing too. Let's get him on the air. Jay, go ahead. Jay?
Yeah.
Go ahead. You're on First Coast Connect.
Hi. Thank you. I think the environmental issue is a great one. I'm glad everybody raised it. I'm more likely to ride my bike along the St. John's River where the landing is, dodging the benches, than I would be to go in there for shopping. You look at urban centers in the city, and we need to recognize our place. We're a large city with a bunch of geographically divided neighborhoods that have their pros and cons. The town center is really an urban core, and to bring people into the landing is just going to be, I think, another waste of money. It's a great point, just to the fact that urban centers aren't there. There's not people living there. There's no easy way to get there other than driving. Looking at a place like Dallas, where they've taken some urban centers and put them into floodplains, great idea. You look at a place like Granville Island in Vancouver, that's an example of how the shops could look and would look. But, again, with so many urban areas, I think it's just not realistic to continue putting money in there. Let's put our monies into our neighborhoods and continue developing our urban centers around the city. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, Jay. Have a good week.
To jump in on that, too, ahead. The fact is that while there are other successful renovated urban centers around there. When you say Baltimore, when you say Miami, those are places you want to hang out. Take a look, for example, in Miami, right down the street from the old Rouse Center, Bayfront, is a huge convention center or arena. There's so much to do there. Baltimore, it's a great walking city. It's a great place to tour, and to have a center renovated like the old Rouse Center there is a lovely idea. What do you do in Jacksonville? You've got the elbow.
Right.
Lovely bars, lovely restaurants, but not much else that's going to draw you to hang out and go multiple places. And, oh, yeah, there's the water. Let's go there, too.
But that really is the chicken and egg question of, so can you develop that sort of thing in downtown Jacksonville if the Landing is a decaying hulk sitting on the
Correct.
River? So you know, you're not going to develop the better things around the Landing until you do something with the Landing. That the question becomes, the you know, what's the point in doing it if nobody's coming down?
So you're saying the Landing redevelopment would be the seed that other things grow from?
Yeah, so though, and this is the other thing, I think, my theory, total theory here,
yeah.
But one of the reasons why I think that the Curry administration is able to feel it can bring pressure on the Landing in a different way is the Lot J development, is the shipyards, is the idea that if that can be done, you actually don't need the Landing in the same way that you used to. I mean, the Landing used to be the center of downtown. You know, if you have a center of gravity pulling people basically down to where we're sitting right now, the Landing isn't quite as important in the scheme of urban development.
But how far out are those developments is a question that I've been wondering. Right around the corner. We're going to see them in 2019. They'll be open and we'll all be hanging out there. You know, I mean, we're looking at all of these empty properties. We're looking at some developments that are coming our way. And my question is, who wants the Landing? Because if the city is trying to evict Sleiman Enterprises, I feel like someone wants that property. It doesn't seem like this would happen in a vacuum.
So, yeah, I mean, one point, and anybody who wants to jump in on this can, is that Jacksonville just doesn't draw the kind of tourism that the places with successful marketplace centers have. You know, that and the caller's point about the town center, you know, being the new urban center, is there just a repolarization here from downtown, Dan?
Well, the bottom line, too, is if we do get the Lot J development down around the sports facilities, that would be a more logical place to hang out, because you'd have sports, you'd have an entertainment venue, you'd have the stage, you would have baseball. Suddenly there's a reason to all congregate down there. And then, of course, if the mayor's plan to get rid of the overhead Hart Expressway makes it more walkable and pretty, then suddenly it shifts everything down to that part of the world and the Landing becomes even less important.
Right, but then I think you have a better argument for tearing it down and turning it back into parkland if you have another place people can congregate. I mean, this mm-hmm. is even with the fight that the administration is having right now with the Landing over permits that seem to be trying to shut down people gathering there for fireworks. That's where people are going to gather. That's where you do this in Jacksonville.
That's where Donald Trump came his first time here.
Right. I mean, the idea that if you bring people from out of town, and sure, we're not a Orlando-level tourism city, but if you have guests and they want to go and look at dolphins in the river, you can still go to the Landing and walk along the river walk, and, you know, there's something there. Might not be the best place to bring people from out of town, but you need a place like that.
And if you get the development across in San Marco, the old healthy town, then obviously you suddenly have a river taxi need between the development that's going in at the sports stadium and there. And suddenly you've got a nexus. And yeah, it's a great place to watch boat races. It's a great place to watch fireworks.
Okay, we've got some callers on hold waiting to weigh in. We've got Laura from San Marco. Laura, how you doing? Please tell us what's on your mind. Laura from San Marco, please weigh in and tell us what's on your mind. First Coast Connect.
Hi there. What about thinking of an aquarium there? I think if we had a world-class aquarium in Jacksonville, it would draw tourism. It would be great for the students, the children we have here, and it's on the water.
Yeah, so you think an aquarium idea would revive the Landing, basically?
I think so. I mean, I'd tear it down and put down a beautiful aquarium, educational facility, science facility.
Okay.
Well, as the caller said, it will soon be underwater. So it's like a naturally occurring aquarium.
You know, that, some scuba gear, and you can be looking at wildlife.
There's our aquarium.
There's been a push to get an aquarium of some sort in Jacksonville for maybe a decade. And it's always
with the convention center.
One of them was trying to put it in with the shipyards and kind of sort of had Shad Khan's consent to that, but that particular plan didn't go anywhere. But there are many people who feel these cities should have one. There was actually fundraising to do so. I'm not sure where that stands right now, but it's never really been able to get off the idea is all wet, basically.
Okay, and we'll get back to the landing. I'm sure this issue isn't going away. I want to move on to some other news. With less than 2 months away from the August primary, the racers' statewide office are beginning to heat up. Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, a Democratic governor candidate, was in Jacksonville yesterday for a couple of events. I caught up with him and asked how he can overcome better-funded candidates like billionaire Jeff Green, who will be in Jacksonville on Monday.
I don't believe that the folks with the wealthiest resume or those with the most money or even those with the most famous name are going to win. I believe that our campaign is representing the kind of authentic, real energy that's showing up on the ground from everyday people. That, in my opinion, is what is going to cross us, get us across the finish line with a win.
Okay. We definitely want your calls on this. 549-2937. Gillum's running third in a lot of polls, Claire, but there are a lot of undecideds. You've been following the Democratic field closely. What have you noticed about the momentum behind Gillum, who's more of a populist candidate than some of the other candidates in that field?
I think that Gillum really speaks well to the Bernie crowd. I think that that's really where his base is at. You know, we're looking at a very crowded field in the Democratic governor's race in Florida. We've got two rich guys, a centrist woman, and then Andrew Gillum, who is more of the populist candidate, who speaks to a little bit more of some of the issues that the younger voters are very engaged with. And he's not afraid to take a stand that may not be popular when you comes around to the general election. So I think that on a lot of people's minds who are undecided is, where do I want to put my vote? Do I want to put my vote in the guy who he speaks really well to the issues that I'm passionate about? I mean, I believe that he's been on record about marijuana legalization and socialized medicine, things like that. Or do we want to vote for someone who is going to be a little bit more palatable in the general facing either Putnam or DeSantis, who are both extreme right candidates? So honestly, if whoever emerges from the Democratic primary is going to have an easy, it's going to be easy for them to differentiate themselves between the opposition.
Okay, Dan, you've followed news in this town for decades, the state for decades. What do you notice about this particular field of candidates compared to, previous cycles? Is there more ideological polarization?
Yeah, you've got a politician, a developer, you've got a rich person, you've got a non-rich person. And my biggest thought would be, when it all boils down, will all of the Democrats out there back whoever wins enough for them to have a chance to beat two well-known Republicans, even though they carry their own baggage too?
So it's basically run to the left or to right, depending on your...
And again, Florida has a tradition of voting certain ways in certain parts of the state, north versus south. So it could be a very interesting outcome, but will there be enough pull for that lone Democrat?
Yeah, that's
so
a question.
So often happens, it seems that Florida is kind of a microcosm of what's happening in the rest of the country, of having to make this decision of, how far left do you go in the Democratic primary, knowing that you'll face the general election and knowing that Florida can be a weird state in trying to figure out how the general electorate will deal with a more liberal Democratic candidate.
Yeah, speaking of left, I won't give this to you, Claire. George Soros has given $750,000 to Gillum, between him and his family. Tom Steyer, $1 million. There's more to come. Are Florida voters going to notice that in terms of a negative? Because it's been messaged by both Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah, they might. I mean, I think particularly Republicans, I don't think that plays very well to the Democratic side. I think they don't really care that much who's giving him money if it's George Soros, as long as it's not the NRA. I mean, that's kind of a deal breaker for a lot of Democrats. It's been an interesting race. I do think that, if from what I'm seeing, it looks like the Republicans most fear Gwen Graham and Andrew Gillum as their opposition, because they know that statistically speaking, you're going to get a lot more people to the polls if you have something that is inspiring, like the first woman who could be governor of Florida or the first African-American who could be governor of Florida. These are things that will really mobilize the base. And the question becomes, who are the Democrats going to nominate? Are they going to nominate somebody who's going to mobilize the extreme of their base, which is sort of a Donald Trump model for the left? Or are they going to nominate someone who's going to speak to the swing voters in the middle? I think it'll be very interesting as we head into these final weeks leading up to the August 28th primary.
Dan, Tim, I want to get you on this question. The Trump factor, that's on the Republican side big time. Donald Trump backs Ron DeSantis. He's got his surrogates coming in to back DeSantis. Putnam doesn't have that backing, but both of them are trying to be the Trumpiest candidate in the field. If these candidates get too far into the Trump lane, can they win in the general, Dan?
I don't know. It depends on how the population feels about the president in the next month and a half. Certainly, things have happened. Different stories as to why the EPA chief resigned. That may turn some people against or for if business people start feeling the impact of those tariffs. Who knows?
We also have, of course, the Puerto Rican influx in Orlando is going to be interesting to see how that plays out. When does that actually, what is generally seen as a massive dislike of the administration, does that actually play over, does that carry over to a candidate that Trump supports? If you're a Puerto Rican voter in Orlando who has reason not to want to support a Trumpian candidate.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically the state of the race right now. We're going to be watching that going forward as we get to the August primary, November general. I want to move to more local news. On Monday was the first day on the job for Diana Green, the new Duval School Superintendent. She came from Manatee County. She had various roles there. Green taught in Duval County in 1985. She interviewed with Lindsay Kilbride of WJCT. She says she wants to get to know everyone and then identify the issues in the district, including the addition of safety resource officers, a very controversial proposal.
We will need to review it, evaluate it, not only yearly, but I believe every 6 months we should go back and decide, can we, if the funding is there, add additional SROs, or do we agree? Maybe we find that the safety officer assistance, that is the best route.
Okay, Claire, are you reassured by that answer?
I mean, it's definitely a nice, I'm not going to say anything right now sort of answer. And that's really what she should be doing. She should be coming in with her ears open and her eyes open and listening and learning as she has indicated she's going to do. And although she does have a familiarity with Duval County, it's been a while since she's lived here. I think it's very sensible of her to take a moment, learn what she can, absorb, and then start implementing her vision for the district.
It can always be frustrating as a reporter to basically do that first interview and ask someone, okay, so what do you plan on doing? And they give answers that are vague. But particularly in this case, I think it's a valid response to say, I'm going to listen, I'm going to make connections, I'm going to, you know, nail down all of the things I need to nail down first, and then we'll start rolling ahead with these things. Because it's such a minefield in education in Duval County of things that you can misstep on early that really could have lasting consequences.
Okay, Dan, you're the crime beat guy. $12.50 an hour for a safety resource officer. What kind of pool are they going to get for $12.50 an hour?
I'm hoping that they will find retired police officers and military who want to continue doing something that is beneficial to their local school and have some training and some brains to handle it. I don't know in the state of Florida how it's overall going to work with the security person there versus a trained police officer, because that's what SROs are. They are trained police officers with a former JSO chief in charge. So they are acting like a real police department, but there's just not enough of them to go around.
Okay. What do you think about that, Claire? I mean, $12.50 an hour?
I mean, that does seem like it seems like it will attract people who are, you know, that's the job for them, $12.50 an hour. I don't know. Maybe they will be great. Maybe they will be people who couldn't make it in police academy. I have no idea. But I don't know that putting more guns in schools is going to make children safer. I don't know that the research will prove that that is the case. And in fact, it may make children far less safe, because we're looking at people who are tasked with making a decision of whether or not to fire a weapon inside of a school. Because that's really why they're there. They're there to take down an active shooter. Well, what if that active shooter has a cap gun or a water pistol or just makes a threatening gesture or reaches into their pants pocket? We see this happen with highly trained, highly experienced police officers where they shoot unarmed suspects based on what they believe is a reasonable fear that they are going to pull a weapon. Are we going to see more of that? And when we do, are we going to be looking at a dead sixth grader? I mean, that is realistically a possibility to putting armed guards in schools, regardless of their level of training.
And we had a trained cop a few weeks ago who was dancing and his gun came out of his holster and went off. So anything can happen, even if you're trained in firearms. Also, we've had two or three incidents in the past month or so, 2 months, with teachers with guns that have gone off in class because they were packing. It is a concern. As a crime reporter, that's the one thing I don't want to talk about is a dead child, period.
Yeah, that's real talk there, Dan. Want to move on also to local politics, making headlines this week. Jacksonville City Council President Aaron Bowman reversed the decision by former President Anna Brochet, who appointed herself and Sam Newby to fill in for suspended duo of Reg and Katrina Brown, indicted on fraud charges, until Rick Scott appoints their replacements. Bowman said the appointments were not legal and that the constituents have 5 at-large council people to represent them. You know, Bowman, of course, is an ally of Mayor Lenny Curry. You know, there's some thought that politics went into the decision. Tim, what do you think about that? Bowman basically reversing Brochet's edict.
I mean, it's a, you know, kind of combination of cliches here, I guess, of a new broom sweeps clean and elections have consequences of, you know, you become council president. Now you get to kind of put your stamp on council. It's a fairly short amount of time that people are in that position. So if he's going to go and do something, you know, he has to move quickly. And, you know, in terms of political payback, this isn't the roughest thing in the world to do. It's almost symbolic, but it clearly is drawing some sort of line between the past and the present.
You know, Dan, so, you know, looking at those districts, I mean, they don't have council people right now. They've got the at-large, but it's not the same in terms of points of contact. You cover a lot of events in those neighborhoods. A lot of crime happens over there. You know, what does the lack of representation mean for those people?
Well, it certainly means there's no one to complain to. Although I have learned over the past few decades that sometimes the council aides are doing more running of a district than a council member is. So hopefully those council aides are taking these comments and passing them on to the right people. But yeah, it is a concern. The cops are very, very overtaxed. They have technology like ShotSpotter there to help them. But it is a very, very nasty place to be if you're in 32209 right now and for the past few years and with no representation and no guarantee that whoever gets appointed by the governor is going to get up to speed quick enough to help, or if they're even going to get a committee position that assists them in making that help happen.
Yeah. We want to take your calls. 549-2937. Tell us what you think about the changes on council. Claire Goforth, I want to go to you for a question here. Anna Brochet, people are talking about her running for mayor. Do you think she can do it against the Lenny Curry machine?
It would be very difficult. She'd certainly have to peel off some big money donors from either the right, which seems to have already, you know, he's absorbed that funding, or the left, in which case, so she's got some funding from the Democratic side or people who are traditionally Democratic donors. Is the Democratic Party going to then support her candidacy? And I don't think so. Or is she going to switch parties? Don't see any indication of that. So I think it's going to be very difficult for her to run against Lenny Curry in the unitary as a Republican, even without a Democrat in the race. I mean, you're going to be talking about a name recognition battle. And, you know, she has a lot of name recognition in the very incestuous community that is the City Hall and downtown area. But he's been mayor for several years, and he has introduced himself to people all over Jacksonville. So she'd have to get her name out there. She'd have to get the kind of money, the kind of, you know, PR campaign. I think it could be done. I do think there's a lot of oppo against Lenny Curry. And when you travel in circles, there's a lot of particularly women in Duval County who took extreme issue with the way the mayor handled the Kids Hope Alliance kerfuffle and also the JEA issue. So, I mean, his support is not universal. I know he lost a lot of points during the JEA debacle, no matter how much he denied it.
And of course, if you go back to the Curry-Brown race, it's not like that was an overwhelming victory for Curry, and Brown was not considered to run a terribly effective campaign. So Curry won that one, but not overwhelmingly. Does that signal some sort of weakness that could be taken advantage of by a better operated campaign? I think Jacksonville also has a history of at least considering, I don't know, call them moderate Republicans, more liberal Republicans, something like that, where obviously the Democrats have not fared as well in the mayoral elections, but there definitely is a contingent that wants a Republican but doesn't necessarily want a hard right Republican. And I'm not sure if the general population has a
view that Curry is hard right, but if a Brochet is in the race, it definitely would kind of draw those lines.
What about the business community, Tim? I mean, you're a business general editor. You deal with the business community all the time. It seems like Curry's got them on lock.
He does. In some ways, I think what Brochet could be going after there is having a similar background. I mean, you look at both of them. I remember this when she was elected as council president. There was a view in the business community that was a good thing. You have two, you know, CPAs. You have two people who have grown businesses, who actually understand the concerns of businesses. I don't know if she's peeled off any of that support, but, you know, at least she has the resume that would enable her to do so. But right now, you know, Curry's relationship with the chamber is very tight. There's not a lot of opening there for someone to take advantage of it.
Definitely not. 549-2937 if you want to talk about the stories of the day. We're going to move on to a Florida Times Union story. Mayor Lenny Curry's net worth declined in 2017 by more than $700,000. He sold part of his ownership interest in the private staffing company, ICX Group. He reported his salary as mayor, $168,095. $251,000 in income from the stock sale. But his net worth is down from $2.6 million to $1.8 million by the end of 2017. Claire, is Mayor Curry doing it wrong? I mean, why would his net worth go down? What do you make of that?
I know, I'm not really sure why his net worth went down. But it is interesting. He's a CPA. He's pitched himself as this brilliant businessman, I believe, and that this does indicate otherwise. I know that the job of mayor is very demanding. I mean, all those trips on Shad Khan's jet and all the press conferences and photo ops, that they fill the day. So doesn't leave a lot of time left over for focusing on business. I'm not sure that this is going to matter to voters at all. It definitely is interesting, but that's really about it.
Okay, 549-2937 for your calls. Dan, why does the story matter to people?
I think Claire just said it. I mean, literally some people will consider if he can't run his own portfolio, then is he the right person to run the city's portfolio? I mean, but again, the market is up and down. It's a beast. Those of us who have 401ks, we know when we get the statement, things sometimes aren't good. It happens.
Well, I mean, there's also the question of, we don't know what income he's getting from ICX or what he was making before he basically left it to be mayor. But, you know, mayor's a full-time job. So if he's not making whatever he was making when he was running his own company, you are going to see a decline in what he has.
So it's the sacrifice of going into the public sector, basically.
Which he may pitch that way.
I'm sure he would.
Yeah, I mean, if he were taking questions on that. Yeah, you know, I want to take your calls, 549-2937. We have Julie on hold from Atlantic Beach. She's going to talk about Lenny Curry. Julie from Atlantic Beach, what's on your mind? Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering, I mean, I'm not an accountant, but could somebody's net worth go down on paper, but not really, so that they're not paying as much money in taxes?
It's not supposed to. I mean, the idea that these forms are supposed to be what they actually have as assets, you know. So, if he, I mean, I'm not an accountant either. He is, but I mean, you know, this is supposed to. The ethics forms are basically just supposed to show what somebody has.
Okay, thanks, Julie, for your call. We got another caller on hold. We got Peter from the beach. Probably not Peter Rummel. Let's see. Peter, welcome to First Coast Connect. Tell us what's on your mind.
Yes, good morning. I'm listening to the experts on the panel, and I'm wondering if the experts listen to themselves, because what I'm hearing is that really who you vote for doesn't matter. The powers that be are already in place, whether it be the Chamber of Commerce, or whether it be Shad Khan, or whether it be the people that want to run the landing, and they're using the mayor to get Sleeman out. So I'm wondering, is this a symptom of just our city and the size of our city, or do other cities have the same issue, cities of our size?
So you're saying big money runs and controls the city and we're just pawns in the game?
Well, he makes an excellent point.
Peter.
I mean, I think that we would all agree that your vote does matter. But at the same time, I think we would all agree that money in politics has not improved since Citizens United, and Jacksonville has long been a city that followed the lead of the chamber and the business interest. I think that is not exceptional. I believe that any city you're going to see, people with high net worth are going to try to influence the process to get what they want. I mean, that is their prerogative. Has Citizens United made that process ever muddier and more inclined to favor what they want? Probably so. And I think that's why we're seeing a slow swell of support to pass a constitutional amendment to overturn that Supreme Court ruling.
And also in a weird, non-cynical moment, I think in some ways the landing fight is almost a hopeful sign. So, you know, if you went back and said Tony Slaman, who is politically powerful, you would expect there to be more getting along with City Hall and that, you know, it's the old boys club just kind of working behind the scenes. You know, in some ways, whether or not this is the whatever outcome you prefer to happen, the idea that you do have powerful interests who are not all on the same page and are trying to chart different courses, you know, that actually is a some sign of, I don't know, a dynamic sort of feel in the city that it's not just old boys club getting together and doing what they want to do.
But yeah, Tony Slaman, I've been there, has been at many news conferences with mayor and senior city officials to support things at the landing and elsewhere. He's previous mayors. He's certainly been a part of that machine.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. Speaking of the process in City Hall, there was a transparency report put out by the Open Government Task Force. Jenna Bourne at Action News Jax reported on it this week. She got some feedback from Aaron Bowman, council president, and Mayor Lenny Curry's chief of staff, Brian Hughes. What was interesting to me about the reportage is that Bowman basically said that emails didn't need to be published from individual council people on city websites because they could have personal information. We talked about this in the green room beforehand, Tim. What do you think of that? Does Bowman's argument make sense?
It seems on the first blush sort of thing to appeal to people who don't think about the process. Well, of course you can't put them online. There might be something sensitive in there, but there's a process. There's council aides going through them and removing them. I mean, right now the mayor's emails go up online. The mayor can have sensitive stuff emailed to him. That does not hit the website. I mean, there are exceptions to Florida open record laws, and if an email comes in about, you know, a deal that's happening, that's exempt. It's not going up. So I think it's maybe slightly disingenuous to say that it can't be done for that reason.
Okay, Dan, your editor, Mary Kelly Palka, participated with me in one of those media panels for the Open Government Task Force, and she talked about how over the years, records and accessibility to city officials has gone down and down. Is that concord with your experience?
It is increasingly difficult to get things from the from City Hall as well as from the sheriff's office. Many times they will state very high rates because they have to redact information. And I understand that we don't need to know certain things about their plumbing or whatever that a constituent writes about. But it does, you're trying to do get a story out, you're trying to get it out in a reasonable amount of time, and it takes weeks sometimes for these processes to go through. Even asking for a police report can take all day now through the new portal system, because it depends if someone's actually working at the other end to process them.
Okay. I mean, I do remember years ago of there being a range of city officials who had their emails online. Not just the mayor, not just council, but you had like department heads who you could actually access, and that's long gone away.
Okay, Claire, I want to get you in here on this. Brian Hughes, Curry's chief of staff, basically said there's no sign-off process on records releasing. The email review has said differently. There actually is documentation that there has in fact been, the records custodian going back to the city and saying, hey, do you want to release this or no? What do you think about this, Claire?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen emails where in the email chain, when I finally get the response, there is a previous email that says, I'm okay to release this, right? So the question is, does that violate Sunshine Law? I did speak with actually Barbara Peterson from the First Amendment Foundation some months ago about this exact issue, specifically getting permission from the subject before they released emails or other records. And she said, well, it may not be, carte blanche problematic, but it could rise to the level of violating Sunshine if it creates an undue delay in getting records requests fulfilled. And if they're allowed to veto the release of records that are subject to public disclosure. I do think that it is the administration's prerogative to say there's no problem with transparency. I mean, what are they going to say? What is anyone in public government going to say? Oh, yes, we're not doing that right. But I think that reporters on the ground, including myself and probably everyone at this table, can say with conviction that there is an issue with getting public records requests fulfilled through the city of Jacksonville, through the sheriff's office. I've been waiting for, I believe it's 4 months, for a very basic records request to be fulfilled from the Office of General Counsel. I mean, and they'll do things like, we'll tell them when our deadline is, they'll wait until 1 hour after our deadline, and then they'll fulfill them. And is that just a coincidence? Or is that them waiting until it's too late for it to get into print? Which, of course, online, it doesn't matter. It's the Wild West there. But, you know, or are they just messing with us? Or we've heard situations where someone will make a public records request, and instead of just answering their public records request, they'll send it to everybody in the media. Just as a little bit of a cat and mouse game, I guess, to get at us. That's what it looks like from this angle.
So, Tim, do you think that the administration, the various offices in the city, play one media outlet against the other?
I think there's probably some of that, but I think there's been a general, over the years, just disliking of transparency and the role of the media, and the idea that they're working on behalf of the public and the public has oversight. And you know, I work for a business journal. We talk to people who do employee reviews all the time. You know, people who obviously have a business that they are trying to run. Well, city government is our business. We hire them, and the idea that we have oversight, I think a lot of people who get in the government now don't particularly like that idea. I remember years ago when public records literally had somebody in general counsel who would review them and release them, and the idea that they know public record law, they know if it's exempt or not, and if it's not, they release it. And the idea that somebody who is, you know, involved in the production of that work gets to weigh in. Anytime there's an email that says, yeah, I'm okay to release that, implies that there might have been an email that said, I'm not. And what happens then?
Yeah. And one of the issues here that I noticed in the media panel at that Open Government Task Force is that as government gets better at obfuscating information, news outlets have less resources to actually chase it. Mm-hmm. You know, Claire, I mean, would there be any way that Folio could make a legal challenge if, you know, records requests were spiked or swept under the rug or what have you?
I mean, I'm a lawyer, so I guess I could handle it, but that would not be a good idea, as I don't practice in that area of law. It would be very difficult for a small outlet. It would be very difficult for a large outlet. I believe that Mary Kelly indicated, you know, how many times should we have to sue to get records? And every single time? And how long should we carry this litigation through? We're talking about thousands of dollars. Legal fees add up very quickly. Attorneys are making their money, and that's, you know, they should.
Attorneys should be paid. Yeah.
They should be paid, but, yeah. You know, what is the philosophy of this? Like, we're going to keep the public business, as Tim was saying, to ourselves because we don't like the public to know it. We have an antagonistic relationship with the media, so we're not going to give them access to information that is exactly subject to public records requests.
Okay. All right, so we got to move on to Only in Florida. It's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. We're finally getting to that. Luckily, there's never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, Only in Florida. Only in Florida does a man go fishing only to hook a bale of marijuana off of Pompano Beach, where Jorge Bustamante made the big catch on Monday, which was also his birthday, the old man in the weed. He did a right thing and called the Coast Guard, but not before he took several pictures of his catch. Authorities gave him the name Square Grouper.
And seaweed?
No. Something fishy
did
about
you say
that.
Old man in the weed? Did I hear you say that?
Yes, she did. It's my Hemingway verbs today. Okay, and all right, so we're going to the next segment. Thanks to Dan Scanlon, Fred Matthews, not here, Claire Goforth, and Timothy Givens. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Thanks, AG.
Bye.
Florida State University License Plates support scholarships for students at FSU, a preeminent institution that enriches and contributes to the state and nation. Gifts for first-time buyers can be found online at fsu.edu/mytag.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. Public broadcasting is a key source for public safety information, and our firm is pleased to address public safety issues on WJCT.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
I'm John Dankosky. This week on Science Friday, in the newest Jurassic Park movie, a volcano threatens the extinction of the last dinosaurs on Earth. Again. But what do real paleontologists think about these movie monsters? It's Science Goes to the Movies with Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. Plus, how did the planet Uranus get tipped on its side? That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Get on the Kellogg's old brand wagon.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of the Kellogg brothers, who invented cornflakes and other breakfast cereals and ran the Battle Creek Sanitarium, which pioneered the concept of wellness. There's lots of surprises in the Kellogg story relating to the Seventh-day Adventists, abstinence, and eugenics. Join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Summer's here. You're probably looking forward to taking a break, but the news doesn't stop. And each week, 1A makes time to pull the handbrake and figure out where each story might be going. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
It's Friday, which is always good news, but today is a special day. It's International Kissing Day. Nearly every creature from prairie dogs to fire ants greet each other with a kiss or a sniff. International Kissing Day celebrates the role kissing plays in cultures throughout the world. And if you're looking for tips on the perfect kiss, God knows I am, and someone to celebrate with, there is no one better to talk about International Kissing Day with than professional matchmaker and founder of Jacksonville's newest Christian matchmaking company, One True Match, Renee Rochelle. Renee, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, so let's talk about kissing. Why is kissing so important that it has its own day of the year?
Actually, it has 3 days. There is National Kissing Day, International Kissing Day, and of course, Valentine's Day.
Right.
So it deserves all three.
Yeah.
A kiss is a powerful thing, whether it is a breathless kiss, first kiss, or your mother kissing a boo-boo. It gives it a powerful expression of how we feel. Its studies have shown that 5% of people over the age of 45 kiss at least 31 times a week.
What about the other 95%?
Right? Well, yeah. The good news is that kissing is good for our mental, emotional, and physical health. So obviously that's an advantage that we all need to take advantage of when we find that one true match.
Right. That's your business. So,
right.
You know, so why does kissing have such power behind it?
It's interesting because over 90% of humankind, some expression of exactly clear to the reason why they kiss.
Right.
Research in the Journal Evolutionary of Psychology explains that kissing between approximately over 1,000 college students.
All at the same time or no?
they've got to kiss somebody, right?
Yeah, exactly.
results that men and women tend to kiss for different reasons. So women tend to kiss to size up a relationship, whereas for men, they say kissing is something more of the means to an end, which turns into a physical end.
Wow.
And there's a lot of chemistry and biology associated with kissing. There is evidence that suggests the first kiss can go a long way in determining attraction, whether a person can become a long-term partner. The first kiss can suggest that if you kiss together well and it's a certain taste and touch, that you could last a long time together.
So it's like pheromones, basically.
Right, yeah. Exactly. But I do tell everybody, just because everybody has a different idea and motives behind kissing, that sometimes a kiss does not mean it will last into a committed relationship with kids.
Right. And you know, that's basically where your Christian matchmaking service, One True Match, comes in. We're on with Renee Rochelle from One True Match. What's the difference between using a matchmaker versus a dating app or a website?
Yes, and it's a good question. People complain all the time that they just can't seem to find that perfect match. Most people complain that are using dating apps.
So swipe left doesn't always work.
No, it doesn't. Right. Come on. on. It's a human, you know, it's a human touch too. But exactly. People are so busy today, especially young professionals, and it takes time and effort, obviously, and energy to find that right match. A One True Match is a personal Christian matchmaking service for singles serious about finding an equal partnership in life. We conduct, extensive personal interviews to make sure that both of you have the same ideas in life and vision and are compatible even in personality. So, you know, our search is confidential. Candidates are pre-screened and we do background checks.
That's good.
And that's huge in today's world when we don't know who people are.
Yeah.
We also provide dating feedback and so much for each date to understand what they obviously can do better or how they then choose that match. So, you know, why we focus on...
Yeah, why do Christian focus?
Yeah, I would say why the Christian focus is because over the years of obviously doing this, we have found that our experience is that most people that we talk to obviously value the core values and the root behind their faith. So that helps obviously as a... is a core purpose, you know, focus
right.
to have.
So, you know, being single in Jacksonville, that's always interesting. Is there good news or bad news for singles in Jacksonville? I mean, it's known as a great family-friendly place, but, you know, the kick is obviously you've got to meet someone first. So how do you go about that?
Exactly. Well, there's actually good news to report on this, which a lot of people don't, you know, agree with. But there is, because Jacksonville is growing and the obviously economic boom, which means people are moving to the area and getting good jobs.
Right.
So 25 to 54 year old is a large percent of the population, which is a perfect age for meeting and getting married and or remarried. And the myth out there is that there are no single people or very few. But according to the 2018 U.S. News report, there's the same number of single people in Jacksonville as the national average. So, you know, the nightlife in Jacksonville is also growing. The art, music, and the art and music scene is exploding, as well as restaurants and so many more things for people to do and obviously meet in their busy lifestyles. So, you know, that's where matchmaking can help you to find that most important date and, you know, person that you're looking for.
Awesome. Renee's got onetruematch.com. She'll have relationship advice there. She'll tell you more about her service there. She's able to be contacted. I want to thank you for being on today.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope that you, obviously, with your lovely wife, have your your international kiss today.
We definitely will have at least one international kiss. That is a promise. Thank you so much.
Good.
And that's our program for today. Thanks to all of our guests, all of our callers, show's producer, Kevin Mearshart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme composed and performed by Peter Chevchik. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send an email, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, and we're rebroadcasting tonight at 8 on 89.9. Don't forget to join us at 1 this afternoon for a Florida Roundup. Coming up next on 1A, the Friday News Roundup. If you're listening to the rebroadcast tonight, stay tuned for music. I'm A.G. Gankarski, and from Melissa Ross, you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, FM Jacksonville, your community, your world.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.